Improvised Europeans, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with cultural historian Alex Zwerdlin. We'll discuss his new book about American literary expatriates at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries.
Well, you know, when I started out on this project, I thought that this would be a story of happy endings and of writers who triumphed over the complex cultural odds that seem to be dominating the literary landscape. But as I work on it, I seem to feel more and more that all of these writers paid a very heavy cost, Adams, James, the others, and their increasing unhappiness in their own country and the feeling that they were losing the...
Cultural historian Alex Zwerdlin. He'll be back in just a moment to discuss Improvised Europeans, his new study of American literary expatriates in turn-of-the-century Europe and America. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Ranging from James Fenimore Cooper to Ernest Hemingway, many American writers have felt compelled to leave this country in order to write about it. Their work constitutes an important strand in American cultural history. Among prominent American literary expatriates are the historian Henry Adams and the novelist Henry James, both of whom lived at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. Both men are central figures in a new book by Alex Zwerdlin, a professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley and a recent fellow of the National Humanities Center. Zwerdlin's book is Improvised Europeans, American Literary Expatriates and the Anglo-Saxon Legacy. He argues that while Adams and James produced work that is important to their own times, they also helped to set the stage for modernist writers like James Joyce, Ezra Pound, and T.S. Eliot. I asked Alex Zwerdlin to talk about Improvised Europeans.
Well, that's the title I want to use, and it's taken from Henry Adams, in fact, from a letter that Adams wrote to Henry James, who was a close friend of his all of his life. And he meant it to apply to both of them and also to a whole group of the like-minded and comparably trained, that is, patricians, as they're so often called, Boston-based, Protestant, highly educated, and all of them having made a kind of unpredictable or peculiar choice in the middle to late 19th century of settling in Europe or living a kind of amphibious life between the United States and Europe and feeling or wanting to feel equally at home in mm-hmm. both parts of the world.
Is to use the word expatriate to use the word alien? Are they necessarily equatable here?
Well, they use the word alien to describe all these new immigrants that were coming to the United States in the late 19th century. And they thought of themselves, of course, as the real Americans, the inheritors, the ones who were who deserved to be, who had always been in positions of power. So if we use the word alienated now, and we tend to do so, it's because of a peculiar shift in power in which the formerly powerful uh-huh. became alien and the alien became powerful, or at least that was in the cards.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about Adams first. Is it fair to say, Alex, that this man's life somehow or other resembles or tells the story of the relationship between the two countries? I mean, you say that he went overseas to be the personal secretary to his father, and in your manuscript you point out that initially this man was the minister to Great Britain or England, and then eventually the title became ambassador, indicating a sort of shift in the relationship. That's a big order to talk about, you know, the relation between two countries in terms of one man's life, but tease that out for me.
Well, I'm not sure it can be done in relation only to Adams's life. It was a major historical shift in power uh-huh. between England and America. America had, of course, been the colony, and in many ways, in the cultural ways that interest me, it was still a colony of Britain's. So that, for example, most of the books that were imported and used by serious American readers came from England. And they subscribe to European journals, and particularly to English and French journals, in a way that I think no American journal could claim. So that the cultural authority was still vested in England. Mm-hmm. And there were countless reputations that were made first in England and then sort of carried over, American reputations that were made first in England, right, and then eventually got to the United States because they had the royal stamp of approval. This includes writers like Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm. Now, you use the word authority, and that in a way goes to the question of this traffic between the two countries. Is it possible to say that Henry Adams symbolizes or embodies for him a happy ending of the story between these two countries, or is this an irresolvable conflict that existed in his mind?
Well, you know, when I started out on this project, I thought that this would be a story of happy endings and of writers who triumphed over the complex cultural odds that seem to be dominating the literary landscape. But as I work on it, I seem to feel more and more that all of these writers paid a very heavy cost. Adams, James, the others, and their increasing unhappiness in their own country, and the feeling that they were losing the sense of audience, of any sort of reliable sense of audience, grows decade by decade.
Uh-huh. You refer to Henry Adams as having written a book that did he give it the title Democracy?
But
he didn't want to be acknowledged as the writer of this book.
No,
he was an affectionate critic, more of a critic than affectionate when he did that book. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, Democracy is supposedly an American novel. That's the subtitle. And it's a devastating satiric picture of Washington politics. And Adams refused to sign his name to it so that the book was published anonymously. The major character is not a Henry Adams-like person. The major character is a woman who has no political power, who can conceivably have some political influence. In fact, she is being wooed by a man named Senator Ratcliffe, who has a very good chance of being the next president. But when she finds out how deeply corrupt he is and how he has managed to sell himself for political gain, mm-hmm. She wants out and departs for parts unknown, more or less, so that there is a kind of expatriation at the end of that novel, which suggests that somebody who is as alienated as she has become in the course of the novel wants no part of this country any longer.
Let's talk about Henry Adams, Alex, in terms of the work that he writes toward the end of his life when he looks at the United States from a European perspective. You note in your manuscript that what he's writing about is he's looking actually at the Middle Ages in Europe, and he's writing about what was then taken to be a kind of a unity in one world's view, and that bumps up against this complexity, the difficulty, the multiplicity of what he sees in the modern world. Now, again, here's a man who's writing almost 100 years ago. That is absolutely headline kind of stuff that we would read today. How do we figure out what's going on in the world? Is that too much of a stretch?
It's quite a stretch, but I don't think he would have been surprised that these debates about multiculturalism and the fragmentation of the United States and the loss of unity, the loss of community, and so on, now dominate our headlines. He predicted all of that, and he didn't, however, see it as in any way a positive development. What he idealized was very much a unified, communal society in which everyone, no matter what his class or status or wealth or whatever, would be working toward agreed upon ends. That's not what America looks like at the moment. It's very conflict ridden, and he probably would say, "I told you so."
Uh-huh. Alex, let's talk about one of the other major characters that you write about in your manuscript here, Improvised Europeans, and that is Henry James. Here again, we have the product of wealth. We have the product of a patrician class, a man who wants to be at home and yet never really somehow achieves that sense of belonging in his own country. Why was it necessary for him to go through all of that travail to be able to write about the United States?
Well, he didn't keep writing about the United States. He wanted very much to feel that he wanted very much that the reader feel that he was perfectly competent to write either about the United States or about any European country, and that his own accidental national identity was of no consequence. He wanted very much to think of himself as a cosmopolitan, and this was, in a sense, a power play.
And is it fair to say that he forsook his country, that he gave up on being an American in order to write the kinds of books that he wrote?
He wouldn't have put it that way until the very, very end. He eventually became a British subject, but that was not until the next to last year of his life, mm-hmm. Virtually the last year of his life in 1915, and it was the accident of American neutrality and Britain being at war that made him declare himself a Briton. You know? But before that, I think he would have said, I am an American. I am doing things for American culture and American literature that will take it out of the provincial mode. Provincialism is a big concept in this whole, among this whole group of writers, that will take it out of this provincial context and give it a kind of world identity.
One of the things that these two men have in common, Alex, as I read your manuscript, we're talking about Henry Adams and Henry James, is, shall we call it the problem of an audience, figuring out who's out there, who's reading Adams's historical work, James's fiction, and talking appropriately and convincingly to these audiences. Tell me about that.
Well, it was a very difficult and increasingly problematic issue, I think. When they began, the ideal for writers of their kind, at least, was to have a large public audience, a large readership, so that they could feel that they were making an impact, having an impact on their society that was indubitable. James's ideal writers were Balzac, Dickens, Thackeray, those writers who were taken seriously by their society, who had an enormous readership and a palpable impact on their society. Adams, too, I think, thought of himself when he was writing as a historian of America in relation to writers like Bancroft, for example, who had an enormous following. And he was deeply disappointed that the work that he produced was read and appreciated by a rather small, relatively speaking, group of the like-minded, maybe an audience of 2,000 or so.
In other words, as their talents increase, their audiences seem to diminish. And what a terrible irony. I mean, we look back at these two writers now and we say that they're part of our national cultural inheritance. Everybody should read them, and yet everybody doesn't read them.
Well, a lot of people read them now, of course, but that's because they have become part of the pantheon, part of what we so often now call the canon. Uh-huh. But there really were no canons for American literature at that time, and so you had to fight your way into it. They, I think, both realized relatively early on in their careers that the kind of ideal that a Dickens, for example, achieved was not likely for them, or that a Bancroft achieved was not likely then, because they were too critical of their societies, and what the societies demanded was a kind of reassurance which they were not willing to provide.
Was the fault in themselves as writers, or the fault in the society that they were writing to? I mean, is this just a rehearsal of the notion that America is essentially, because it's egalitarian, it's anti-intellectual? It doesn't take ideas seriously.
Well, they would have said that the fault was increasingly in the society and in the readership. But I don't think that we see it that way any longer, or at least many people do not. They were not willing to make the kinds of compromises that a writer, say, like Harriet Beecher Stowe made, or that Dickens made, to reach the large audience that they wanted.
Although they were envious of writers like that.
That's right.
One of the things that Henry James writes about, in a way, it brings together the questions of international diplomacy, the rise and fall of nations, and individual psychology. One of the things that he writes about is modern marriage. How is that a kind of an emblem of not only international relationships, but very personal ones as well?
Well, there were, of course, a number of quite significant international marriages that were occurring in the late 19th century, some of them very famous by now because, among others, Jenny Jerome, who became Jenny Churchill, became the mother of, she was married to Randolph Churchill, and she became the mother of Winston Churchill, who was always a proponent of the so-called special relationship. In fact, he invented the term between England and America. Mm-hmm. So there were a significant number of marriages of American heiresses, usually, to titled Englishmen. And James became one of the witnesses and recorders of that phenomenon.
He has great fun with this in his books. I mean,
yes.
And some of it is, can we call it autobiographical? The fact that he himself never married, that he was coming, however uneasily, to terms with that fact?
I think so, but not, of course, in any direct way. I believe, I mean, this is just an interpretation, and I have no absolute proof for it, but I believe that one of the reasons that the whole phenomenon of international marriages interested him so much was that the tensions that are inevitable in an international marriage, where people are coming with completely different cultural expectations, exacerbated the sense of marriage as a highly problematic condition that one wouldn't want to enter into without one's eyes very wide open indeed. Uh-huh. James was very reluctant to marry. I think he was not a heterosexual, although I don't believe he was an active homosexual either. And so this was a way of writing indirectly about some of the issues that concerned him personally in a way that wouldn't give away his deep personal investment in the subject.
Uh-huh. Regardless of who he's writing about, whether it's Protestants or Catholics, Jewish people, whatever, you say, for instance, here that James is not anti-Semitic in a way that Henry Adams was. He's not writing so much about race or ethnicity. I believe you say that he's writing about culture, about the way cultures interact.
Yes.
Am I right?
Well, particularly in the book that he writes after coming back to the United States in 1904 and 5 for the first time in 20 years, the book is called The American Scene, and it was published in 1907. He is extremely interested in the impact that these new immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe have on this culture. When I say that he's not anti-Semitic, I think that he has no racial feelings about Jews, for example, unlike Henry Adams, who did, and unlike Eliot and Pound, who also did. He's very aware that the cultural reconstruction of the United States is going to involve the heavy prominence of people like this, because he can see immediately, even though most of them are poor and not even educated, that they have a kind of intellectual and cultural seriousness about them, that they are the people of the book, and that eventually they will, if not dominate, at least play a prominent role in the new American culture.
He goes and he visits a Yiddish neighborhood in New York, and he says, these people are more at home here than I am, and I'm an American, and they're the ones who are supposed to be the immigrants. Alex,
yes.
Tell me about a term, apropos of that you use in your manuscript, in your book, about Americans and Europeans, and that is Anglo-Saxon. Now, obviously, that's a field of study. That's a kind of a geographical designation. What did it mean to these people that you're writing about?
It meant a lot of things. Unfortunately, it's not a category that can easily be defined, and its very fluidity was actually politically useful to some of them. But it meant, largely speaking, the cultural stock, or the racial stock. I hesitate to use the word racial, but they did all the time, uh-huh. So I have to use it.
We don't see that. We don't think categorically in those terms.
No, because I think that we use the word race now not to divide various Europeans from each other as they did in 100 years ago, but to distinguish Europeans from other so-called races, like the Asian races and so on, mm-hmm. or Africans. But in the 1880s and 1890s, race was used, European race was not considered single and undivided. It consisted of a number of races, one of them the so-called Nordics or Anglo-Saxons. Those terms were sometimes used interchangeably, sometimes not. The Mediterraneans, the Slavs, and so on. And major distinctions were made among those various races so that those who were working for immigration restriction at the time and who eventually achieved their goals could distinguish between the desirable Western and Northern European immigrants and those coming from Eastern and Southern Europe who were considered less desirable.
You say, for example, that the number of immigrants arriving in the United States, what was it, roughly after the turn of the century for the first 10 or 15 years, it tripled or quadrupled,
yeah,
and therefore
it
created a lot of fears. It's like the kind of thing that we hear today when we talk about what cultural force is going to dominate in our national agenda. It's a replaying of that same circumstance. Am I right?
I think so. And it created the same sense of alarm, of panic, of the feeling that the United States could not absorb all these so-called alien immigrants, that they were unassimilable, that the melting pot would break down.
So there may be some lessons to history, so to speak. Maybe not direct parallels, but it's instructive to look back.
I think so. Yeah. And the thing that strikes me looking back now is that so many of the people who immigrated from 1850 or so to 1920, when immigration restriction became a law in the United States from Europe, were thought to be absolutely unassimilable. And it seems to me that if you look back now, all of those people coming from Southern and Eastern Europe have in fact been assimilated into the United States, not without conflict, of course, but It now seems unnecessary
happened.
To make those distinctions.
Right.
Perhaps 100 years from now, we will look at the kind of panic that seems to be dominating cultural discourse at the moment about so-called alien races with as much skepticism as we now look at the dialogue of the 1880s and 90s and turn of the century.
Well, we can hope for that. Alex, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We've been talking in very large generalities here about international relations and diplomacy and writers, particularly Henry Adams and Henry James. How do these two writers that you've been discussing and the cultural patterns that they represent, how do they usher us into the modern world of what we call modern literature, apropos of feeling at home, feeling alienated, feeling oneself to be an American or a European? That's a big order.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that strikes me as very important is the growing sense that the audience that a serious writer addresses is a small audience rather than the general audience, and that there's something good about having a readership which can be numbered in the hundreds or the couple of thousand rather than the mass readership.
Yeah, Adam said, you give me 500 and we'll reach the half million, isn't that?
Well, that's what he said at the beginning of his career. He no longer believed it by the end of it. And one of the changes that I see from the beginning to the end of his career is just the loss of faith in the significance and power of the 500 or so to reach the mass audience. Increasingly, in the early 20th century, as the modernist movement becomes a significant factor, many writers, both in England and America and in other European countries as well, seem to me to settle, reluctantly perhaps, but nevertheless settle with a certain amount of confidence in the choice of addressing a relatively small, a coterie audience, and saying, that's inevitable if you want to write seriously.
Mm-hmm. So we move rather more quickly than the stereotypes would tell us from Dickens to the modern novel. That is to say, the writer who just sweepingly addresses the entire world in contrast to writers who have very, very small and limited goals. Not bad ones, but small and limited audiences.
Well, some of it, of course, turns out to be completely wrong. You know, I mean, Adams was convinced that no more than 100 people existed to read The Education of Henry Adams. I'm sure the book has sold hundreds of thousands of copies, has certainly been read by hundreds of thousands of readers. When to move to another country. When Joyce publishes Ulysses, or rather when Sylvia Beach publishes Ulysses for Joyce, he writes to her that there is no point in publishing more than 200 copies of that novel because there couldn't conceivably be more readers than that who would take it seriously.
And hasn't it been the case that just recently Philip Roth has pronounced for us that there are 60,000 serious readers in the United States and that's it?
Yeah, well, that's a later chapter of the same story where he feels, I think, that the audience that he of people who read fiction seriously now has shrunken because of television and movies and so on. Uh-huh. But it's another form of the argument about mass culture versus elite culture.
Right. Alex, I want to thank you for this overview of your work. You are Alex Zwerdling, professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley. You've just completed a year at the National Humanities Center working on a book that has the provisional title Improvised Europeans. You've written about Yeats. You've written about Orwell, Virginia Woolf. Alex, I appreciate very much your participation on Soundings, and I wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was cultural historian Alex Zwerdling, a professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley. Alex Zwerdling's new book is Improvised Europeans, an account of turn-of-the-century literary expatriates in Europe and America. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 674. That's number 674, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Next week, Faith, Gender, and Identity in Medieval English Verse. Join me for a conversation with Elizabeth Kirk, an English professor at Brown University. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.